You are listening to Right On Radio on KFAI 90.3 FM and streaming live on the web at KFAI.org. I'm Liz Olds. Tonight on Right On Radio, David Fedick talks with Jessica Winney, the author of Everything I Am, a collection of poems, verse, meditation, and inspiration. Jessica is a teacher, entrepreneur, activist, and writer living in Minneapolis who has also traveled and lived around the world. Everything I Am fuses her persona, personal stories with events that affect us all, offering a powerful collaborative reading experience.
And I'm Josh Weber. In the last part of the hour, Liz Olds talks with Patrick Hicks, the author of the acclaimed novel, The Commandant of Lubitsek, as well as several other novels. His poetry and essays have appeared in many of the most important literary journals in North America, as well as heard on NPR and the PBS NewsHour. He has received fellowships from the Bush Arts Foundation, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Loft Literary Center in Minneapolis. He is a writer in residence of Augustana University and a faculty member of the MFA program at Sierra Nevada University. He lives in South Dakota with his wife and son. All of this and more. Stay tuned to Right On Radio. And
thank you, Josh.
Thank you.
Hi, Jessica.
Hello.
Welcome to the show. Welcome to Right On Radio.
Thank you. Excited to be here.
Well, we're excited to have you. We love our Minneapolis writers and especially our Minneapolis poets. And it's especially nice to meet you because we've met via email for other reasons, which we will discuss later.
Okay.
But we're here to talk about your beautiful poetry. And before we get a reading from you to kick things off and give people a sense for your work, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to poetry? I believe this is your second collection. Is that right?
That is correct. I started writing when I was younger. My father gave me a space to be safe and also opportunity. It was kind of the way that we bridged our relationship during the time. And so poetry has always been a not only a place of expression, but also a place of healing for me. And as well as I'm a teacher as well. And so it's been great to be able to give my passion and gift to my students as well.
You speak about healing and teaching, and I feel like we should address what happened today before we go on. And I don't even know what to say about that other than a lot of feelings, a lot of emotions, some relief.
Yes, for me, it's definitely been a memorable moment in history. A first step in holding police accountable. And also, for me, it doesn't take away the trauma of the past year or the past years or the past decades. And so that's where I'm at. I'm writing and I'm sharing and I am, you know, connecting with people that I wouldn't have otherwise. And so I think that's valuable too.
Yeah, I imagined you today as I was preparing for this, actually sitting down and writing about today. And I'm sure that's happened already, or maybe it will, because I get the sense from reading your book that if you're feeling it, you're writing it. Because there is Jessica on every page of this book. I can just get a sense for that.
Yeah.
Jessica, let's give people a sense of your work. And is there a particular poem you'd like to read for us to get things started?
I was going to read the first poem in my first book that I wrote when I was 12.
Great.
Yeah. It's called Peace of Mind. And I'm always in awe of this because this was in 1988. And why would a child have this to say?
Right.
So it's called Peace of Mind.
Great.
The day will come when I can sit down, rest my feet, and let my soul take a breath. The world will stand still. And the time will stop ticking. All I dream to get accomplished will be done. And I'll have time to give my mind a piece of itself.
Look at that.
Yeah.
What made you pick that poem out?
Just because that's where it started. That's where my first, that I kept all of my work since I was younger. And my first book is called The Collection, Life's Rhythms, Rolled Over Times. And that's actually the first poem in the book. So I thought it was fitting to start with that, since that's kind of where everything began.
I love it. I love it. And we gave a sense for this, Jessica, in the intro. I tried to anyway, that your book, Everything I Am. It's a beautiful book in the sense that there's artwork in it.
There's
of course, there's lots of poetry. There's artwork. There's meditations, I guess I would call them. And it almost feels like lyrics in here. Some of these poems feel like lyrics to me. I almost imagined you singing them. That's how they read to me.
I can speak to the artwork is from one of my former students. His name is Jesus Arangure. There are three artists featured in the book, but his work shows up the most.
Yeah.
And I had him as a sixth grader years ago. He graduated last year.
Wow.
And so we have kept in touch over the years, and that was his passion, is art. And so that was one of the ways that I could get him to get his math work done or get him to sit down and read. It was like, okay, draw, and you like get this done and then you can draw. And so we still, I texted with him last week. It's one of the reasons that I teach those connections to young people as they grow up and still, still have that connection. My seventh grade teacher did the editing of the book. Her name is Flory Summers. And we still keep in touch, too. So it has been a spiral of beautiful interactions and relationships that have brought me to this space. So I'm blessed for that.
Yeah. And what inspired you to put this book together like that with artwork? Did you do it in your first collection also?
So the first collection has just photographs. I think art is not present enough in a lot of things. And so I wanted it to be interactive for the reader. As you know, there's also after each section space for you to write or draw however the piece moves you. I wanted people to kind of have it as a journal in a sense. Mm-hmm. And it's cool because some of the poetry that he drew to, I said, you know, here's my thoughts. And then others, I said, here's the poem and you create. And whatever comes from your inspiration from the words, then that's what it is. And then my nephew as well, Akil Elamine, he also did the graphic work for the cover. And so as much as it is about my poetry, it is also about just bringing a group of people together that I know and love and support.
It feels like that. It really reads like that. I would say from my reading of it that love is a powerful theme throughout this book and in many of these poems, whether it's physical love, emotional love, universal love, body, heart, and mind.
Yeah.
There's love on every page. Am I reading that right?
You are. I write a lot about love, the ups and downs, the title, definitely Everything I Am. I want it to encompass my, the ugly sides of my life, relationships, life, death, you know, everything that I am that has brought me to this point where I'm at today. That book covers 10 years of poetry. And so even though as we edited and took stuff out, it's long. But there were things in there that I felt that, poems are spaces that I had been mentally or places that I had been physically that I felt needed to be there, needed to be recorded. And so, a lot of being vulnerable and hoping that when people read, they're able to grab hold of something that they find in common or take a lesson away from something that I wrote. And so I feel like that is the gift in writing as well.
Yeah, and I think that's a beautiful gift that many poets give. And these poems certainly do that, that vulnerability that you described that allows the reader to embrace that, those same feelings within themselves.
I have one called Love Lines.
You want to read it for us?
Sure. It says, my warmth when I'm cold, my smile when I am glad, like a forehead kiss when I need compassion. My umbrella in the rain, like a roof when I need shelter, my exchange, my hand in his palm. If my love line was damaged along the way on this journey, surely his healing embrace extended it for a lifetime, my palm in his hand.
I love that. Thank you. And I'm glad you read this poem because you like to, I was going to say play with words, but that's not serious enough. My hand is in his palm, and then you finish with my palm in his hand. Yes. You do this throughout your poems. You're very careful about the words you choose. Obviously, you're a poet, but you like to remind us that there are refrains in here. Themes circle back within the poems. It's just a lovely example of that.
I give all credit again back to my Flory Summers. My dad taught me the passion of writing, and Flory taught me the books that she had us read, imagery, taught me how to use literature in the way that was comfortable for me. Vocabulary, like twisting words around, synonyms, everything. So I thank her often.
Well, that's wonderful. Yeah. And there's rhymes sometimes in these poems.
Yeah.
And surprising rhymes. It's not rhymes where you expect them to land necessarily, like at the end of a stanza.
Yeah.
But within the same line. And I know it's intentional. And that's when I start thinking if they start feeling like lyrics to me. Do you imagine some of these as lyrics? Do you hear music when?
I do. And sometimes I write to instrumentals. I often write to instrumentals. It could be classical, jazz, whatever, different beats. It could be rap music. I'll just take away the rap music and listen to the beats in the back. So definitely that has happened on occasion.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned you're singing because I know that you're a singer because you shared something very special with me during an email correspondence. Of a performance of one of your poems. Yeah. And you've agreed to perform that for us. This is a very special moment for Write on Radio. We usually don't get poets singing their work, and it's going to be very special. I was very moved by it. But before we do have that from you, tell us about your performance of your poetry. Pre-COVID, have you performed? Have you gone to readings yourself?
Yeah, so there are two events, one hosted by Tangible Thoughts and another hosted by a group called Mac House that create safe Black spaces for artists. And so in the past year, I've been able to work with them. And I have never been a performing poet. No. It was never something I'm a writer. I don't perform. And so being in those spaces and being courageous enough to share your work was definitely a blessing. And so over the past probably 2 years, I have performed a lot. I've been able to perform alongside some of who I would say are Minneapolis's spoken word artists and teachers and historians in spoken word from Minneapolis. So that's been a blessing. And also the stage is welcoming and also vulnerable again. So it has so we miss it, but we Black Table Arts over in South Minneapolis, they have an event called Sip and Chai or Chai and Chill. I believe it's called Chai and Chill. And so that is a monthly gathering as well. And so poets show up or people who love poetry who just write just for their own self show up and share space together. So
nice. Yeah. I'll remind our listeners that this episode will be on our website, Write on Radio. Do a Google search or look on KFAI. If you want to hear Jessica mention those names again, I was writing them down myself. I'm going to have to listen to it again to catch them. And then we also have a podcast. So this will be on our podcast forever and ever. So please tell your friends. So Jessica, set us up for what you're about to do here.
So this poem, this piece, I guess, is called The Movement. It has changed over time. I wrote it maybe 2 years ago and 2 or 3 years ago. It's definitely one of the pieces that in the book that happened in the later part of the decade that it covers. So I'll just go with it.
Go with it.
See how it goes. Sick of Trump's dumb lies. This is why we bills piled so darn high. Need us a new deal. Reparations, my. Better grab your nine. It's revolution time. The movement requires you to be uncomfortable, to take up space together and gather at Right On Radio and raise your hand to ask questions. Why? Why do unarmed, handcuffed Black men leave crime scenes dead? Yet armed white mass shooters leave crime scenes alive. Why? The movement requires you to spend within your community to transform your patterns and live without Starbucks, Home Depot, Walmart. The movement requires you to recycle dead presidents into the hands, the shades of yours, to allow difference into your journey, to take up space on the sidewalk. The movement requires you to adapt to situations, to amend your life for the revolution, to support Black businesses, Omari Brows, Lipesteem, Sammy's Deli and Eatery, Minnesota Black Box, Selby Spirits and Wine, Willard's Bar, Palmer's Bar. The movement requires you to raise your fist for injustice, to say their names, Sandra Bland, Tatiana Jefferson, Corin Gaines, to speak their names, Eric Gardner, Trayvon Martin, Tamir Rice, to say their names, Tysel Nelson, Thurman Blevins Jr., Philando Castile, George Floyd. We are tired. We are exhausted of adding names to this list. Dante Wright. The movement requires you to raise your fist for injustice, to exercise your 15th Amendment, to be noticed Black excellence, to take notice of your Black excellence, to sprinkle your Black boy joy and blow your Black girl magic everywhere you go. The movement requires you. The movement requires us. You know how I feel.
Wow, Jessica, no one's going to believe that you just happened to be on the show tonight. We planned this months ago, but what By whatever magic you appeared tonight, we are sure blessed for it. That was really something. Thank you.
It comes from a space of heartache. It comes from a space of resilience. It comes from a place of pressing on and thinking about what we need to do collectively and how we can manifest and continue to transform our societies, our communities, our lives, and be about action.
Well said. Anyone who doesn't think that poetry, art, music, performance don't matter and can't make a difference, they need to listen to what just happened here. Mm-hmm. Jessica, that was beautiful. I'm going to take that opportunity, because you referenced Black business and some particular businesses, and I love Sammy's, by the way.
Yes.
So thanks for that shout out to them. I'm sure they'd be good. But I have an article you wrote for the Minnesota Spokesman Reporter. Yes.
Yeah.
Which I subscribe to, but which you wrote, and you begin quoting this poem, and then you describe something that you're involved with, which is Minnesota Black Box, which is how we came to know each other. Yeah. So if you don't mind turning away from your beautiful work for a moment and tell us about your other beautiful work.
Yes. So Minnesota Black Box was started in May of 2020, and we are a collective of business owners, community members, strangers, and we are dedicated to promoting and financially supporting Minnesota Black businesses. So we curate a monthly box featuring 5 to 7 businesses a month, and our website is www.minnesotablackbox.com. To date, we have been able to give a platform for over 125 local businesses and about 7 businesses nationwide.
Wow.
And so it's exciting. It has been it has been a roller coaster.
I bet. And,
It has been exciting. I'll say I'm thankful for my children, my friends, the volunteers, the people I have met and connected with along the way have been very inspirational outside of the work that it takes. I don't know if you can see. Well, you can see in back of me. So
yes,
once was the Blue Room, which is a space to read and sing and relax in and just debrief from the day, has turned half of it into a workspace. So it is
Well, it's
excited though.
It's amazing. The businesses you feature are just fantastic. Some of them become regular customers of mine. I encourage everyone to check it out. mnblackbox.com, as you said. Yeah. It's really fantastic.
Thank you. It's been we're here. We are devoted and committed to continue to think about generational wealth, to think about the sustainability of these businesses, and also to create a safe space for business owners to network with each other, bounce ideas off each other, give constructive criticism to each other. And it has been, I'm thankful. I'm just a vessel. I know that the work that we are doing is important.
Yeah.
My grandparents taught us about service. They were missionaries and members of the Hennepin Methodist Church over uptownish area for over 50 years. And so they always instilled the value in us of service and how do you continue to serve others. Mm-hmm. So that is that kind of centers what we do.
Yeah. It's such a great idea. We could talk about that for a long time.
Yes.
I want to come back. Go ahead.
My teacher, Flory, her sister passed away today.
Oh,
she had been in hospice. And so I wanted to read something for her.
Perfect.
It's called Angel Kisses.
Very good.
At times I sit in the dark so I can see. The shadows bounce as the blackness whispers secrets. I listen to the stories, connecting myself to the other side. Fearless of the movements that beckon me to exhale, realizing you are always with me, and so I am no longer afraid. And I love you, Flory.
That was beautiful, sweet. Yeah. I'm glad you had the opportunity to do that. They're going to give me the 2-minute warning here pretty quick. So I'm glad you gave me another, another reading.
No problem.
So you've been writing these poems for 10 years. You talked about changing. There's a poem, I believe, See I'm Changing, in here somewhere. How is writing poetry? There's our 2-minute warning, Jessica. Okay. How has writing poetry changed you?
I would say the writing poetry has changed me because it has pushed me to accept who I am. And although we strive for perfection, we're going to make mistakes along the way. And if you can look in the mirror and be true to who you are and be true to yourself, all of you, I feel like you can navigate life a little bit easier because you cannot give to the world until you give to yourself first.
Yeah.
And that takes, it's not something, I'm 44, is not something that I know it's a continuous battle. When you think about mental health, when you think about physical health, all of those things that can plague us, how do you stay centered with who you are, how you were raised, the traditions and family values that you were brought up in, being open to other ideas and suggestions, yet still remaining in your true to you.
Yeah.
And so that's how poetry has changed me. It has allowed me to manifest things within my mind that I didn't know existed. It has allowed me to reach spaces that I didn't want to go to because of trauma, because of fear of who will accept this part of me. And so when I could write about it, I could get it out, and then I could share it, and then I could heal. And in hopes to heal someone else through my journey and the places that I have been that were good and bad, you know?
Yeah, great. Right.
Yeah.
Well, lucky for us that you have done that, Jessica. And everyone who's listening will realize, and from the poetry they've heard, that everything I am really is everything in here.
It's a lot in there.
It's a lot in here, Jessica.
There is. It's a lot to uncover.
That's sure. Right. And people should take note. Everything I Am, a collection of poetry by Jessica Winnie, Winnie. What a treat. What a pleasure. Please tell all your friends, ladies and gentlemen, what you experienced this evening, and get on the website, listen to it, get on our podcast, and send it around. It's been a pleasure to finally meet you, and I look forward to seeing you again.
Wonderful. Later. I appreciate you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye.
Have a good evening.
You too. And now this.
Hello,
yes,
Patrick.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great.
Yep, I'm here.
We're speaking tonight with Patrick Hicks, author of In the Shadow of Dora, as well as many other books. I want to start with the reading, but before we do that, why don't you give us a little background about the book and the reading?
Oh, sure thing. In the Shadow of Dora, it's about the real life connections between the Holocaust and the Apollo program. And it required many years of research, and the book was published several months ago. And I'm really pleased that it's finding an audience in spite of the pandemic. And the discussions in particular that I've been having on Zoom with audiences about these two really important events of the 20th century has been really intellectually nourishing. Would you like me to do a reading now?
Oh, yes. If you would do the reading, that'd be great.
Sure thing. I'm going to read, this is only two pages, but it gives you sort of a flavor of what the writing style is like, I suppose. But the novel takes place in a real-life concentration camp, a secret underground concentration camp where they built rockets. And at the time, it was the world's largest underground factory. And I know that sounds like science fiction, but the V2 rocket was used by the Nazis at the end of the war, and it was fired at London and Paris and Brussels. And this highest of high technology was being built by enslaved people, Jews and French and Soviet prisoners of war in this secret unknown concentration camp, which even today, I'm not sure people are very familiar with, and that's largely because of what was found there. And the Nazi scientists that built the V2 rocket, the United States, we made a really Faustian bargain. We brought them to the United States and we said, you know, build us the best rockets, the best jet planes, and best in aerospace, and we won't charge you with crimes against humanity. So that's where the intersection between the Holocaust and the Apollo program come about. I'm very happy to talk a bit more about that. But this particular two pages that I've chosen comes from a chapter called The Vengeance Weapon, which sort of explains what the V-2 was. The world's first long-range rocket weighed almost 28,000 pounds, and it was so technologically advanced that Nazi Germany became the first country to put an object made by human hands into space. The Kármán line marks the boundary between our world and the starry black that lies beyond. Thus, at least according to this measure, space begins 100 kilometers above sea level, which is roughly 62 miles straight up. During one particular test in the summer of 1944, launching from an island on the Baltic coast called Gervisvalda Oya, the V-2 soared past the Kármán line by almost 50 miles. The Nazis, however, weren't interested in setting altitude records. They only cared about height so that the V-2 could arc over the top of a deadly parabola and scream its way back towards Earth, where it would punch holes into cities hundreds of miles away. The V-2 was never designed to stay up in the heavens. It was designed to fall. The rocket was essentially an enormous projectile that didn't require a cannon. A button was pushed, fuel ignited in blinding fury, and off it went into the clouds. Although Eli, he's my main character, had no way of knowing it at the time, he and the other prisoners at Dora Mittelbau were building the world's first ballistic missile. He later came to understand its terrible destructive power and that the V stood for Vergeltungswaffe, vengeance weapon. For its victims, it blew open the door to the next world. The V-2 was the brainchild of a young man named Werner von Braun. Quick with a smile, he made parties sparkle with laughter, and he was known as something of a ladies' man. Though only in his 20s, von Braun knew how to organize, how to charm, and most importantly, how to turn blueprints into realities. He was the center of gravity for the V-2 program at Peenemünde. All major decisions orbited around him, and he made sure his rockets hit their intended targets. Von Braun joined the Nazi Party in 1937, and 3 years later, Heinrich Himmler personally invited him to join the SS. Although von Braun accepted this commission, he would spend the rest of his life bending attention away from the fact that he was involved with the same organization that ran Dachau, Treblinka, and Auschwitz. At first, Hitler was totally unimpressed with the V-2. He saw it as simply a massive artillery shell with an extremely long range. But as Germany began to lose the war, he slowly warmed to the idea. He wanted to punish the Allies by turning their pretty little cities into smoldering wastelands. On a July evening of 1943, von Braun dimmed the lights in an underground bunker and showed the Führer a silent movie of a V-2 taking off. As the color film splashed life against a concrete-reinforced wall, Hitler sat slumped in a wooden chair, a black cape draped over his shoulders. He watched the rocket shoot into the sky on a mute flame, then it arced away at three times the speed of sound. Hitler beamed and jumped to his feet. He wanted to know what the annihilating effect of the warhead might be, and apologized that he hadn't believed in the project sooner. Clapping his hands together, he made the young SS officer a professor on the spot, a rare honor. Within days, an order was given for thousands of V-2s to be built. The goal was to launch them like locusts towards New York, Washington, D.C., and maybe in time they could even reach Chicago. That gives you a, sort of an idea of the narrative voice and maybe also the level of research that went into writing this novel.
That's part of what I was going to ask you about. We're talking with Patrick Hicks, author of In the Shadow of Dora. One of my questions was, how did you find out about Dora Mittelbau? Were you already writing a book and you found this out, or did you find this out and then decide to write the book?
Oh, yeah, I love that question. Well, my first novel was, it's The Commandant of Lubezeck, and it came out in 2014, and it's about a Nazi death camp. And, writing that was hard enough, but, I toured it around the country, and it was really kind of hard to talk about the Holocaust all the time. So I thought, well, for my second novel, I'm going to focus on the Apollo program, because I'm kind of a gigantic space nerd. But as I started to think about what that novel might look like, it occurred to me, the same Nazi scientists that built the V-2 were in charge of NASA, and they got us to the moon. Without those Nazi scientists, I'm very confident in saying we would not have gotten to the moon by the end of the 1960s as Kennedy wanted us to. So as I started to think about this, I thought, well, maybe I could set the first half of the novel in Dora Mittelbau, and the second half would be at the Kennedy Space Center. And what if my main character was tormented by people when he was a prisoner of in Dora Mittelbau, and then he works for NASA to get us to the moon? I kind of wondered what that plot would look like, and the novel really took off from there. But it's really an intersection of my two great research interests, which is World War II, the Holocaust, and space.
This must have taken a ton of research. How much was how much was the research that you did, like letters and diaries and stuff like that, and how much was books that you discovered? It seems to me...
Yeah, it was monumental. I mean, I don't think I'm going to do another novel that has quite this much research, although never say never. I mean, who knows what's going to happen again. I do love the research component. So I knew quite a bit already going into it because I teach courses on the Holocaust, so I knew that part pretty well. I knew the space part pretty well. But I applied for a number of grants, and I got something like $12,000 worth of grants, and I went to Dora Mittelbau on two separate occasions so that I could get inside these secret underground tunnels. And of course, since it's a concentration camp, it's now a memorial and an education center outside of the German town of Nordhausen. So I went there on two separate occasions. I talked to the curators and looked through archives and things like that, and I read a lot of accounts of the men, and they're almost all men at Dora Mittelbau, the men who had managed to survive that camp and then go on to lead lives. And then I also went to the Kennedy Space Center on one occasion. I went to the Johnson Space Flight Center in Houston, and I went to the Marshall Space Flight Center in Birmingham, Alabama, which is where the Saturn V was originally developed and built by Wernher von Braun and the other Nazi scientists. So to finally sort of answer your question, it was years of research. It didn't take me too long to write the first draft of this novel. I would say maybe 3 or 4 months, but I kept chipping away at the research to make sure that I had everything accurate, because I have strong feelings that even though I'm writing fiction, if it's historical fiction, I got to get the history right, especially if I'm writing about the Holocaust. I would see it as a moral imperative for me to get that correct.
I know that this is the second book of a trilogy. Is that right?
It is. So the first one, The Commandant of Lubezeck, really looks at memory and how, what's erased. And it was an investigation of the death camps that were a part of the Holocaust. They're very different from the concentration camps. So I wrote about that. And the second book is really about the acquisition of technology and how technology is developed and changed and the morality of technology. I mean, we've got this amazing Saturn V, which takes us to the moon, but it begins life as this Nazi rocket, which murdered an awful lot of people. And the third novel, which I'm going to start writing over the summer once the school year ends, it's going to take place in a real-life all-female camp called Ravensbrück, which is just north of Berlin. Mm-hmm. And I've already gone there on one occasion. And I want to look at the intersections between gender and violence, because it was an all-female camp, that meant that female guards were the ones that were there. And they were every bit as malicious and vicious as their male counterparts in the other camp. And I want to sort of explore, the microcosm of that particular camp.
That sounds interesting. Is that the one where the women played in the orchestra, or is that a different camp?
Oh, no, you are not totally incorrect. There were women that played in the orchestra, but I suspect, Liz, you're probably thinking of Auschwitz, because there was a band. There were a number of bands and orchestras at Auschwitz, largely to pacify people, to make them believe that they were getting showers rather than entering the gas chambers. But each camp, and I've been to about 11 or 12 concentration camps because of my research, both as a writer and as a scholar, and each camp has its own sort of sociological microcosm to it. And I'm not talking just the layout of the camp is a little bit different. There's, you know, certain aspects of the things that happened inside that camp, or each camp is sort of unique in that respect. You know, it's like every horror is kind of fresh and new and invented, and depending on which camp you go to.
I imagine, on a not a different topic, but a little bit different approach, that these books must have brought out a lot of emotion and sadness and difficult feelings. And I wondered how you kept yourself going, refreshed yourself, healed yourself while you were writing both books and in between the books.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, these were really brutal to write at times, especially the first novel, because it's a death camp, you know. It was really hard. The first draft, I had the very vivid nightmares that it was really hard to sleep while I was writing the first draft. Once I got to the second, third, or seventh draft, you know, my editorial eye sort of took over, and that's kind of offered some sort of protective lens or emotional lens, you know, that because at that point it's all craft and trying to make the story work. But the first draft, both of these novels, was pretty brutal. So I didn't realize it at the time, but while I was working on my first novel, I was also writing a collection of poetry about the adoption of our son. And I realize now, this was all subconscious back when I was doing it, but I realize now that, you know, that my novel is about darkness and genocide, and here was this poetry collection I was working on simultaneously, which is about love and life and hope for the future, and, you know, it's basically a bunch of love letters to my son. And I see now in retrospect that I needed to write that collection of poetry to kind of heal myself, as you say. And when it came time to writing this second novel, In the Shadow of Dora, you know, the first part does take place in Dora Mittelbau, so that was hard. But the second part of it takes place in Florida, and my main character is building a new life for himself. So there's necessarily more of an element of hope in my second book, which I think kind of buoyed me in some kind of way.
Would you say, Eli, I realize they didn't have this terminology then, but would you say in the midst of some of the things that he needs to do for himself that he had PTSD?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That phrase did not exist. I don't think it existed really up until maybe post-Vietnam, but at any rate. Well, as he's trying to rebuild his life, I mean, he is visiting psychiatrists, and, you know, he's just trying to figure out what the world looks like after he's lost his entire family. I mean, all of his extended family perished in Auschwitz. So, he, in my estimation, he definitely is suffering from post-traumatic stress. I mean, how couldn't he? And he's got to sort of figure out how to carry the crushing weight of the Holocaust with him every day. And I believe that Holocaust survivors, they, especially the ones that are alive now, they've had to figure out how to carry that pain with them. I don't think that that's something you can heal from. It's not something you could or should get beyond. And I think you just have to learn how to carry the trauma of that with you, and then find love and life and reasons to sort of continue on. So I did an awful lot of research in part two about how Holocaust survivors, what were their coping mechanisms for carrying this with them, and that was a really gratifying type of research that I did, just trying to figure out what that looked like.
I'm wondering, I assume you do a lot of readings, and I'm wondering you kind of do a lot of readings. I'm wondering if you, or how you have been responded to. I know you're Irish-American Catholic guy, and I'm wondering how the Jewish community and especially survivors have responded to your book.
Yeah, and I'll be totally honest with you. When my first novel was published, I had no idea what to expect, and I was hoping that they'd see it as respectful and accurate, more than anything else, that it's accurate. Again, my comments about it, although it's a novel, you still have to have accuracy and history. And the first novel, I toured it all over the place, and there was one reading in particular I remember where the person that had invited me to read, the room was like 50, 60 people in the room, and he told me before I went out, he said, many of the people in this room are Jewish, and many of them lost family members in the camps. And that was a bracing moment for me. And, I went out and I talked about the book and the research. I read some passages from the Commandant of Lubavitch. And I was just so gratified by the response. And it seemed clear to me more than one of them said they were just really grateful that I, a Goy, an Irish Catholic, from Stillwater, Minnesota, would take such interest and time to commemorate the Holocaust and to get, books out there that might be used to help students in particular understand it a little better. And in fact, my first novel is read in high schools. So I find that really gratifying. And I remember when the evening came to a close, there was a nice Jewish grandmother who came up to me and she said, do you like pie? And I was like, yeah, I love pie. And she's like, you must have pie. So she took me back to her house, which was only a couple of blocks away, and we had pie with some of the other survivors there. So I kind of thought, that made me feel better, that maybe I was telling the story with accuracy and emotion that is resonating.
You teach writing. I'm wondering if teaching writing has helped in terms of the emotions and how you approach your students, and if many of them have read the book, or, what's it like to teach differently from the writing, and what do your students think?
Oh, yeah. And I have, because I teach at Augustana University, so I teach mostly traditionally aged college students, 18 to 22. But I also teach in the MFA program at Sierra Nevada University, where there, most of my students are older than 30, and, they've been around the block a few times, and maybe they've even had some types of publications. So I really deal with two very different groups of writers, and I intentionally target what I'm going to be teaching into higher order things and lower order things. So my introduction to creative writing course, we're not going to be talking about some of the more advanced things that you need to think about, like with perspective and the dialogic imagination and a few other things like that. But it's really wonderful to see my students really begin to craft stories that are good, and I can see them taking these ideas and putting them in the mix of their brain and coming up with really good stories. So it's really gratifying, especially since I can see that they're, especially my college age students, they're getting a sense of confidence with their literary voice. And I mean, that's wonderful. Whether they go on to become published writers or not is really secondary to my goal of just giving them the confidence in their writing to write with to get on the page what's in their head.
You also write essays, if I'm not mistaken. You've been nominated for several Pushcart prizes. What kind of stuff do you like to write about in your essays?
I wrote an essay that was published in Alaska Quarterly Review a couple of years ago, and I'm sort of, how do I word this without sounding totally arrogant here? Because I don't mean it that way. But it's an essay I've been wanting to write for years and years. And finally, one January, I sat down and wrote it, because my mom is an immigrant from Northern Ireland, and the Titanic was built in Northern Ireland. And my uncle died in a horrifying car accident when I was only about 4 or 5 years old. And it's a braided essay about the Titanic sinking below the waves, and my uncle crashing into a stationary truck like an iceberg, and his coffin sinking away, and the sense of loss and immigration. So that's an essay I published a couple of years ago called In the Shadow of the Titanic. But I'm working on an essay right now and I'm going to start shopping it around pretty soon, called Borderlands, where I've been to a number of contentious borders in the world because of my travels. So I'm sort of investigating that negative space where two countries can exist, but neither of them really owns the space, and what it means to cross borders. So, like, I was at the DMZ between North and South Korea. I've been in the West Bank. I lived in Belfast for a while during the Troubles, and there are the peace walls between the Catholic and Protestants. I lived in Germany for a while, so I saw the Berlin Wall very shortly after 1989. So I'm working on that right now, and I'm really pleased at how it's come together. This doesn't feel like it's quite ready for publication. So I know that's a long answer, but you got me fired up to talk about my latest writing project.
That's a good answer. Braided essays are kind of difficult. As a writer, I know that. How would you say this book has changed you in the large sense of both your thinking and your emotions and your writing? I mean, how has it changed everything?
Wow, that's well, I know it's this was a craft problem that I came along when I was writing the first draft of In the Shadow of Dora. The first part of it takes place in Nazi Germany in a, you know, the secret underground concentration camp, and I went into that feeling pretty confident that I would be able to write that well enough that it'd make me, you know, content for a first draft. And then when I finished the first part, and I had to transition to writing about the Kennedy Space Center in the year 1969, I was really naive, quite frankly, because I remember sitting down at my computer, and I wrote the first paragraph of my character, who's now in Florida, and the year is 1969, and I realized, just because this is my country, and I know my country's history well, I had to rethink everything, because I was like, oh, God, my main character is a Holocaust survivor. He's lost his whole family. I mean, what do the 1960s look like to him? What does the Cold War look like to him? How would he feel about the civil rights marches? I'm positive he'd be in favor of, you know, civil rights. So I had to really stop myself and really remind myself with every sentence that I need to look at America in 1969 through the eyeballs of my character, who would definitely be seeing America differently than maybe we think about the 1960s today. You know, there's no hippie kids. You know, there's no sense of wood. There's no mention of Woodstock. The Vietnam War comes up occasionally, but it's, you know, just something that's on my character's radar. And he finds himself looking at a newspaper, for example, you know, and the headline reads, you know, another 21 Americans die in Vietnam. And from his perspective, that is nothing. You know, if you think about his experiences of going through the Holocaust. So that was something that I had to reimagine my own country's history through the eyes of an immigrant that has suffered this horrifying trauma.
Well, we have run out of time, Patrick. We've been speaking with Patrick Hicks, author of In the Shadow of Dora and some other amazing books and essays and poetry. Do you have anything you want to finish up with? Anything you'd like to tell us?
I'm just really grateful to be on the show. Thank you so much, because I know that you know, have a lot of people that you could choose as guests, and I really appreciated the time, not just to talk about the novel, but I'm aware that the novel is a vehicle that allows me to speak about a moment in world history that we should not forget and cannot forget. And if I'm being honest, that's one of the reasons I wrote these books, is that it affords me the possibility to come on shows like yours and to talk about these horrifying events that happened in the 1930s and 1940s anew.
Well, thank you very much. We must never forget. And
yes.
And that's all we have to talk about tonight. Thank you, Patrick Hicks. And I hope people will seek out your novel, In the Shadow of Dora, as well as The Commandant of Lubecek. Is that how you pronounce it?
That's correct. Yes.
I got it right.
Thank you so much, Liz.
You bet. Take care.
All right. Bye.